my name is Dick. You'll also hear Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick attempt to organize this enthusiastic crew that meets most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and a hell of a lot beyond that. We live in exciting times. If you don't believe it, just wait till Paul tells you what the latest is going on with NASA. For instance, in a month or so, they're going to launch the Mars Science Laboratory, the Curiosity device, which is going to be about as big as a Volkswagen. And it's going to roam around Mars and look for past life. We've heard about the Kepler mission, which has discovered a planet going around two separate suns simultaneously, and thousands of planets that are candidates for life going around other stars. The Large Hadron Collider and the Fermi Lab are discovering that some evidence is showing up that neutrinos move faster than the speed of light when they're going through the Earth. As I said, if you're interested in science, radio science, wireless technology, we live in exciting times. So you're in the right place at the right time. We try to tap into that brain power that exists into... Let me drop. The TechNet tries to tap into the brain power that exists in the tri-state area. This repeater has moderately good coverage of northeastern New Jersey, southern New York State, Long Island, and southwestern Connecticut. So in that New York City metropolitan area, there's quite a bit of brain power. We try to tap into that. There's no particular subject that's verboten, per se, with reference to science on this particular TechNet. There are people who dislike that. They say nothing but ham radio should be discussed. Well, from my point of view, inside of a real ham radio operator, there was a scientist. And so you see lots of evidence of that. And if a person is displeased by that, there's 800 channels on that 2-meter handy talkie of yours. You can tune to one of the other 799 if you want to. So be forewarned ahead of time that that kind of material will be discussed a little bit later on. We make an attempt during the first hour to at least give a brief answer to everyone's question. And I'm going to make it a little bit earlier than that tonight, where we're normally at the 9 o'clock period. We go over to Mel's mailbag, and for the new hams that are trying to get into ham radio, who haven't got a voice yet, they haven't got that license, they can't get on here, they mail Mel an email or a snail mail with their particular questions. You remember what it was like when you first got into ham radio. You had a zillion questions. What kind of an antenna? What kind of transmission line? What kind of a transmitter? What kind of a receiver? How does it work? What's the protocol that these guys and the vocabulary they use to talk to each other? It's hard for you to remember, but we all had those millions of questions. So Mel attempts to answer those. There are times when he gets 300 emails per week. So somebody out there has questions. Somebody is listening. Let me drop. The person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A sign-in might sound like this, KC2MDP, Steve, and yes. Steve's one of our frequent sign-ins, for instance. So by that, we know who has a question, and the subject matter that was discussed on the TechNet almost always are the subjects that you guys bring up with your questions. Beyond the 9 o'clock period, after a mailbag, we also go to Paul's, give us a space report. WS2N keeps track of what NASA has been doing. NASA's doing some very exciting things. And after that, quite often what happens is the people who are more interested in science and things that are happening at the molecular level, we get into that from time to time, because that's where it really all starts. Those are little electrons that are running around that piece of copper wire that you call an antenna. That's where it begins. And from there, all kinds of good things happen. All right. If you've got a question or a comment for the net, please sign in with your call letters, your name, and that word yes. KQRIW, and we're listening.
Hi, Russ, yes.
KC2RFM, Alan, yes.
Hey, Sue, KEY, believe it or not, I got a question also, Dick.
Fantastic. All right, we got Russ, Alan, and some guy named Mel. Okay. Russ, your call letters got covered up, so Russ, please give me your call letters again.
AC2GY.
Is that Kilo Charlie 2 Golf Yankee, Russ?
Alpha Charlie.
Okay, Alpha Charlie 2, Golf Yankee, that's Russ. KC2RFN is Alan. K2KEY is Mel. Okay, that's a good lineup. Anyone else want to check in at this time? Give me your call with a real question or comment. Give me your call letters and the word yes with your name right now.
WS2N, Paul, Space Report. Good evening, Dick.
Glad to hear it, Mel. Paul. Okay. Got that list. And one last call. Anyone else with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes right now. 45, we got more than enough. Russ, you're number one on the runway, and you're allowed to ask anything except subjects about antennas. And that was a joke, Russ. AC2GY, K2RIW.
Well, joke appreciated, but I'm not asking about antennas. I'm asking about a bizarre problem that I've had for the last few days that I think almost everybody on the repeater has been hearing, and that's been me rebroadcasting WCBS AM 880. I finally solved the problem by attaching a ground lead between the power supply, the grounding bolt on the power supply, and the male end of the SO239 connector on the antenna lead leaving the radio, leaving the transceiver. My question is, if you can, and everyone who's been helping me try to fix this, and I think a lot of people were curious as they were helping me, Dick, my question is, why would that have attenuated the interfering station, the interfering AM station that I was retransmitting via my mobile here?
Let me ask you this question. Is there some chance I've got you confused with someone else? But during the week, there was a man who had a system in his house where the transmitter was on one floor and the control of the transmitter through wiring was on another floor. In other words, a wired system but remotely controlled. Is there the possibility that you are that fella that I was hearing going through that testing procedure of the signals that were being coupled through? Is that you, Russ? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, that was me, but just so you know, that had absolutely nothing to do with it. What actually was solving the problem is when I had the remote head of the radio on the radio, I was standing in proximity of the radio, and my body was acting as an RF something ground to the incoming AM station. I figured this out by extending the microphone about 20 feet away, and I also figured it out by keying the microphone and basically putting a little rubber band around it and stepping away and listening on an HT. And when I was not proximal to the transceiver, I was retransmitting the AM station.
You're fairly sure that it was WCBS, which I think has its transmitter in New Jersey. I believe you're located in Port Washington, which is a good number of miles away. So, in other words, the station that you believe was coming through, how well confirmed was that? And was that the nearest AM station? Because from you to what I think is the location of CBS in New Jersey, there's probably a healthy 25 miles. Give me a guess on that one before we proceed. Over to you, Russ.
Two other stations actually heard them announce their call letters, and it was WCBS Radio AM 8800. So, Andy, WA2CDL heard them, and there was another station out there that heard the other station, so we absolutely confirm it was that station. Back to you.
I heard W2 something, but extremely weak. And I don't know if we're going to be able to pull out the audio. In the case of electromagnetic interference, really solving those problems at times are bizarre. And you're just seeing a little bit of a hint of that. The situation is not too different from what happens with the Department of Homeland Security. A terrorist group can make 100 attempts to do some really nasty things in the terrorist arena. And if one of them succeeds, and 99 of them fail, the terrorist group can call it success. The Department of Homeland Security does all the investigation they can to try to eliminate the 100 terrorist attempts, and if one succeeds, they call it failure. You can see the mathematics really staggered in a crazy way between what the Department of Homeland Security does and what a terrorist group does. In the case of electromagnetic interference, there's a zillion ways that a signal can crawl through. The good news about radio and wireless is that once you issue a transmitted radio signal onto an antenna and it gets radiated into space, that radio signal goes to every single cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop that from happening. That radio signal, once emitted, goes everywhere. The only thing left to discuss is that where you're standing, where you've put your equipment, is that signal right now above the threshold where it can be detected on your particular equipment? So there's a zillion ways the signal can get there. When it comes to doing shielding practices, let me drop. So the natural nature of that radio signal is to go everywhere. And that you and I say, well, I don't want it going here. I don't want it getting into my microphone circuit. I don't want it getting into the Morse code keying circuit. I don't want it getting into the power supply and so on. The art and science, and there's a whole lot of art to electromagnetic interference. A couple of my good friends worked for the EMC department of Airborne Instruments Laboratory. And your story, as strange as it sounds, is minor compared to the stories they ran into. The most severe situation they ran into is inside the jamming pod of an EA-6B airplane. EA-6B is that Navy airplane, carrier-based, which does standoff jamming. Each one of those jamming pods can put out thousands and thousands of watts of transmitting power. The transmitter itself, the actual low-power oscillator that determines what frequency that thing is transmitting on, is in the middle of that pod, and approximately 2 feet away is the high-power output of the transmitter. So you've got a tiny little oscillator running a milliwatt going through a whole lot of electronics and eventually gets radiated by the feed horn inside that jamming pod, and it's only a couple of feet away, and thousands of watts are coming out. You've got tremendous amounts of delta in signal strength between the beginning of the signal and what finally comes out. And what was required to make that system work was not real good shielding, not real good double shielding, but real good triple shielding. Each individual layer of shielding done real well is capable under the ideal conditions of 90 decibels of isolation. And you want to talk about a severe requirement. Now, when it comes to transmitting signals like audio over a relatively long distance, twisted pair with audio does a medium good job if and only if the twisted pair audio starts off
repeater, timeout, cancel.
If the twisted pair audio starts off with a thoroughly floating microphone, the signal is thoroughly differential. In other words, if your microphone was, for instance, just as a crazy example, you got a microphone with a preamplifier and it's putting out a 2-volt signal. If one wire at one instant of time has exactly +1 volt and the other wire has -1 volt, so between the two wires there's 2 volts, but those two wires are used in a thoroughly balanced manner at the source. And if the receiving device is not just a simple amplifier running between one of those wires and ground, it is a thoroughly floating, fully differential receiving device that only looks at the differential voltage between those two wires, and it completely cancels the common mode. If those two wires had an extraneous signal that makes them both go up and down by 1 volt, at the same time the differential voltage is 2 volts, if that receiving device is truly running in the differential mode with a lot of common mode rejection, what looks like an almost unshielded system can have 100-some-odd decibels of isolation. So how you hook up the source of the audio, how you receive the sync of the audio, how you shield it and whatever, there's a whole lot of things that can go on. So to simply explain what happened in your case, in other words, if a person did enough investigation, let me drop.
Tom at W2OSR.
Yeah, Bob recognized. You'll sometimes find that the thing that you call ground at the chassis end of the receiver and the thing that you call ground at the sending end of the microphone, there can be a hell of a lot of voltage difference between what you think is ground. This really comes about in hospitals, for instance, where a person can turn on a high current device like a vacuum cleaner two rooms away, and the voltage it puts onto the grounding system of the hospital, the guard wire, the third lead of the plug that goes into the wall, can at times create enough voltage differential to upset the equipment. We haven't got an exact answer, as you can tell, Russ, but Bob wants to give us a comment. I think it was Bob. Yeah, or was it Bernie? Oh, no, oh, sorry, yes, it was Bob. W2OSR, go ahead, Bob. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, just a little clarification. WCBS Radio's transmitting antenna for their AM station is located on City Island, less than a mile from Fort Washington, and I know they're running a full 50,000 watts.
Very glad you told me that, Bob. The plot thickens. Okay. When you get a 50,000 watt transmitter a mile away, you're probably almost inside of the reactive near field. You're not, but you're getting close. When I talk about the reactive near field, every antenna has three regions of range. If you're really far away from the antenna, everybody calls it the far field. Everyone calls it the Fraunhofer zone. When you start getting closer, they call it the Fresnel zone or the near field zone. And if you're really near the antenna, they call it the reactive near field. Real close to an antenna, you have some extremely strong local magnetic fields and electrostatic fields that are not necessarily representative of what the signal will look like when it's fully transmitted. Under normal circumstances in the far field, every time you double the distance between you and the transmitter, the signal goes 4 to 1 weaker. It's called the inverse square law. Double the distance, you get 1/4 the power. You start getting real close, and the signal doesn't increase or fall off with square law. It starts getting cube law, fourth law, fifth law, and so on. You get real close, you can get some extremely strong local magnetic field. That's part of what was going on with that jamming pod in the EA-6B airplane, that Navy airplane. So a mile away from a high-power transmitter, probably with a 600-foot-high antenna and 50,000 watts into it, in that situation, to make sure you've got no extraneous signal being picked up by your radio, you might require something like 90 or 100 decibels of shielding. On top of that, what can easily happen is that the signal that gets through your wiring is strong enough in radio signal, maybe that's a 700 kilohertz signal, that it gets rectified by one of the transistorized stages, and therefore the amplitude modulated audio, the envelope of the audio of WCBS, gets superimposed on the audio of your microphone circuit, for instance. So a person who's real skilled at electromagnetic compatibility, solving those problems, EMC, electromagnetic interference problems, he learns a whole lot of tricks. He learns how to look at the word ground and the word shielding. There are times when you've got a shield or shielded braid over your wires for your microphone circuit, and by removing the ground on one side, the degree of shielding can actually increase because current flowing between the differential grounds through the shield can induce a signal into the wires inside. So there are times when it's crazy. I know I haven't given you anywhere near an exact answer, Russ, but I've given you some of the ingredients of it. In the beginning, an EMC expert does a whole lot of experimenting, just like you did. Try this, try that, add this, add that. And eventually you find out, you build up a whole bag full of tricks of the things that work under this circumstance and don't work under that circumstance. And so you try to remember all those, you make up a notebook of the things that work and the conditions under which they work, and you hope you get a chance to use them again. One last thing I want to tell you.
Hey, you wanted to comment?
Very good, Mel. Every single electromagnetic interference problem, with rare exception, is solvable. You use the right kind of shielding, you use the right kind of filtering, you use the right kind of grounding, you use the right kind of schematic diagram, like fully differential circuits. Almost every circuit, no matter every situation, no matter how severe, You're getting television interference. You're getting telephone interference. They are all solvable if you have enough diligence, enough perseverance. I bet you've run into some really weird ones, Mel, and give us some words on that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I have another comment, W2OSR.
Bob recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel. Take your time.
Okay, good evening all again. Nice to be with you. This is K2KEY. He's got what I did when I was 7 years old, a crystal radio. It's funny, when I put it together, didn't have any diodes at the time. We had what they're known as the cat whisker. And I found all of a sudden at that time, actually I had a bad connection in the circuit. I was trying to put the cat whisker thing, but of course had very little soldering skills, in fact, no soldering skills, nor soldering iron, everything. Everything was twisted together. And this bad connection I had acted as the, I guess you would want to call it, the crystal diode, the detector, the cat whisker assembly and all. And my antenna, I found, this is when I was 7 years old, if I had a wire just clipped to the telephone, the dialing plate on the telephone had that little thumb thing, or the finger stop, you know, that little silver little metal finger stop on the old dial-up phone. If you put your, and use that as your antenna source, I was receiving local, I was in WOR, WCBS, radio, AM radio, Dick. And that's all it took. Loose connection is something worse. If I tightened up the connection, I would have ruined my crystal radio over.
It's kind of amazing how a rusty bolt can act as a rectifier. Mr. Bose in 1890 was building detector circuits that consisted of nothing more than a sharp piece of metal touching a sharp point on one piece of sheet metal, touching a piece of galvanized steel on the other side. That became a diode when it was done real carefully. Mel is talking about what we used to call the Galena crystal. You bought this little crystal that was mounted in a round metal base, and you had this thing called a cat whisker, which really is kind of a pointer off to one side, and you probed that Galena crystal with this pointer, and it had a spring and a holder mechanism and a little bit of a handle off to one side by which you could move it around, and when you found the magic spot, when you got good rectification and your crystal radio worked, you're off and running. There was an article in Popular Science magazine way back in 1949 that my father and I responded to, where if you took a Gillette Blue Blade razor blade and used it as the crystal, and you put your cat whisker into it at just the right angle, you got a crystal diode detector out of that. And we heard the local WHLI radio station in Farmingdale when I was living there. So you'd be amazed how anything with a slight nonlinearity, with not perfect contact, particularly compression contacts, can give you rectification and signal amplification and so on. So shielding, rectification, you got to worry about all these things when it comes to interference. There's only a zillion ways the interference can get into your circuit, Russ. And you as the engineer have to be perseverant enough to eliminate each one of them. The chain is no stronger than the weakest link. There are times when there are five ways the interfering signal is getting into the circuit, and you very diligently remove all four, and you think, well, this thing is impossible. I removed all the ones I can find, and the signal is still getting there. And you think that one of the four that you removed didn't really get
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Until you find every one of them, until you find that fifth one, the problem is not going to go away. Bob, give us some more horror stories that you run through. W2OSR, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Yeah, what's called the Gillette Razor Foxhole Radio, Dick.
A Foxhole Radio. And that was in Popular Science, among other places. Bob, you got it.
Okay, Dick, just to give you an idea of the scope of the problem up here on the North Shore, since we're so close to WCBS, I'm just across Hempstead Harbor from Port Washington. I now have my Yaesu FT950 connected to my dummy load. My ham shack is in the basement. I have probably about 3 feet of coax going from the radio to the dummy load, which is my Heathkit antenna. I am listening to WCBS AM radio at S1.
Doesn't surprise me. And is it getting in through the shielding of your coax cable because it's not double shielded? Is it getting through the shielding of your dummy load? Is it getting through the 12-volt wiring that goes back to your power supply? Is it getting through the 110-volt line cord? When Mel was using the little finger stop on his telephone as an antenna, he really was connecting to the grounding of the metal telephone, which Mel Labs had way back in those days, which in turn was getting into the wiring, and that wiring goes through his house and goes for miles all the way back to the central station for the telephone company. All of that becomes an antenna just by simply connecting to that little finger stop. So I know what you asked, Russ, was how is it happening in your case? I know we did not answer your question directly. There's only a zillion ways it can happen when you've got a local strong signal, and you've got to eliminate every one of those ways in order for the problem to go away. And until you learn all of these tricks of an electromagnetic interference expert, you just have to keep trying everything you can think of, every idea that all your friends suggest to you. You will eventually get there. Don't give up. And remember the things you did, because those are going to be pieces of experience that you're going to be using in later life, because if you stick with electronics and radio and wireless, guarantee something like this is going to happen again. Alpha Charlie 2, Golf Yankee, K2RAW. You got it, Russ.
Thank you. I appreciate the advice. What actually made me think of doing it is I remembered when I set up live microphones for a theatrical presentation, we were getting interference actually from the electrical service in the building. And even though everything was chassis grounded to the building, out of desperation before this show was going to open, I basically took an extension cord, cut the hot neutral, and I left just the ground line coming from the plug. I took that and I just threw it over all of the microphone lines when they entered the audio mixer. Magically, at that moment I didn't care, the interference was gone. So I was wondering if it was the same thing in this case, and that's what made me go down the path of trying to ground the antenna cable to the power supply ground. Anyway, thanks for everything that you spoke about. It was a very interesting discussion, and I don't think you didn't answer it. I think you didn't answer it because it's an impossible question to answer, even if you solve one yourself. And to anyone else who's listening, thank you all for all your advice. AC2GY.
ABT-JXM. Yeah, under ordinary circumstances, the 12-volt wiring into a well-made rig is shielded by a large number of decibels, maybe 80, 90, maybe even 100 decibels. But when you've got a local broadcast station a mile away with 50 kilowatts of power on a low enough frequency, all of your 12-volt wiring to that power supply and 110-volt wiring to that power supply can easily pick up the signal. And you're picking up some number of microvolts per foot of wire or millivolts per foot of wire, and all of a sudden the shielding requirement goes through the roof, and so all kinds of things that can buck out the signal, humbucking circuits, so to speak, can sometimes do it. The person who just signed in, who gave us your call letters extremely fast, I didn't catch them, and please give me the call letters again. Do give us a hint as to whether or not you're adding to this or you want your name on the list. That new person, go ahead, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, this is KB2, Julius, X-ray Michael. My name is Gary. And I just wanted to do a comment about the Christmas radio.
Okay, your signal is very noisy, Gary. So briefly tell us something about a crystal radio. But bear in mind, we're only going to be hearing about 80% of your words.
Yeah, I'm in the mobile right now, but when I was a kid and I got this schematic for a crystal radio out of a Boy Scout manual, I made one, and I just ran one wire, only it's about 150 feet out the window, but I always noticed the signal came stronger. If I pulled on the long wire a little bit, I don't know if I added capacitance or what, and the antenna, when I pull on it, you know, because there was a slight bit of slack in the middle, but if I pulled on it, the signal came in stronger, so I'm thinking to myself, well, why don't I just get a pole and got higher, but no, that didn't do it. It was just more or less the thing that I put my hands on the wire and pulled it tighter to get the thing up higher, which the pole did the same thing, but no, only my hands would increase the amplitude of the signal.
Yeah, your hand on that wire, Gary, adds a whole lot of capacitance. A human being completely floating on a, you know, standing on a wooden stand represents something like 100 picofarad to the rest of the universe. You add that extra 100 picofarad, it changes the tuning of the antenna. On top of that, your body is picking up signal and adding it to the wire. So were you adding signal? Were you changing the tuning? All of the above. So that radio is strange. Until you get down to the nitty-gritty of finding out what's going on, antennas always work better when they come closer to the resonant frequency of operation. When it comes to transmitting, you will resonate your antenna before you radiate, with rare exception. Receivers are very forgiving. You can put a radio piece of wire, a clip lead, onto the center conductor of your SO239, PL259 on the back of the rig, and you can do a lot of good receiving. But you can't transmit through that. There's a whole bunch of explanation for why that happens. So, and as you do resonate the antenna, the S meter will get stronger and stronger, and you'll be hearing weaker and weaker signals. Okay, Alan is next. Haven't heard to you for a long time. KC2RFN is about to pick up. Alan, as you probably know, is the guy who nominated the Technical Net for the award. It got a national award last year, and we thank you an awful lot for doing that, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It was my pleasure, Dick. I actually have my main question, but this conversation brought up another one. Is it okay if I ask Mel a question?
Go for it. There's a small fee involved, but we'll just debit your account. You got it, Alan.
Okay, KC2RFN. Mel, with your crystal radio you were talking about, how did you change the tuning so that you were able to get different radio stations? I built a bunch of crystal radios when I was a kid. I could never really control the tuning. How did you do it?
No, I didn't have a variable capacitor. Basically, those crystal radios was random. You may sometimes hear a couple of radio stations superimposed on each other. But you had a tapped coil, the one that Vic is referring to. It had only about three parts. It had a coil. It had the razor blade with this little, with this carbon, piece of carbon from a pencil, from a lead pencil. And it had also a pair of headphones. And you had this tap coil that you made there, and you played around with the tap. You played around with the thing to the razor blade, the pickup. You just did whatever you could, Alan. And you may hear a station and you left it alone, but you heard another one also at the same time. It was not unusual. There was no definitive tuning. This was like a throwback to early days of Marconi and all, when he used a thing called the coherer. It was basically, this was not much, in fact, this was not more advanced than what they used, believe it or not, and Marconi claimed he heard a signal across the ocean with a thing called, like, not much more sophisticated than that, with a coherer, which was a very simple device. I could say usually like three, maybe four parts. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me add to this one, Mel. Most of the designs for the crystal radios that we built way back in the 40s and 50s, you started off with a Quaker Oats oatmeal cardboard tube, the Quaker Oats oatmeal cereal. You wound X number of turns of usually cloth-covered but sometimes enameled wire on that, and the end of that then went to the actual wire that went into the backyard. So I think it was kind of a base loading coil trying to resonate that overall antenna so you get the increased signal. Depending on how you set up your Galena crystal, your razor blade crystal detector, it added different amounts of resistance, different amount of capacitance to the circuit. I think, in theory, a person could take a 365 picofarad air variable capacitor, tack it across the right number of turns on that loading coil, and as you swing that capacitor, I think there was a chance you might be able to favor one AM broadcast station over another. You guys are more advanced than us way out there on the in Suffolk County. You guys in Brooklyn, I'll bet you some of you guys did experiments like that and were able to select one radio station over another. I'm guessing. I wonder if you can confirm that, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I was 7 years old. I doubt if I would, variable capacitor literally dropped on my head, if I would know what it was. I was 7 years old, Vic. How it got to work, my father and I dickering around, he, at seven, whatever I knew, believe me, he knew a little less than me about it. He says I have no, he was just like, being a good pop, which he was. Whatever I used to ask him with antennas as I grew up and everything like that, he was always there. What I used to just tell me what you want to do. So, a variable capacitor? No, I never had a variable capacitor 7 years old. Like I say, I remember the oatmeal box, of course. You get these oatmeal boxes, but what was most popular, a lot of times you used a tube from toilet paper. The cardboard tube from toilet paper was also another popular way of winding a coil. And, a number of them told you put little taps by taking a turn, and you grab the end of that turn and you give it a twist and skin it off there, scrape it off, and then you go on, continue on with your coil, and you move your tap. This was the radio, like I say, Dick, over.
That's right, number 22-gauge wire.
22-gauge wire. As you move those taps, Mel, were you moving the taps to get the strongest reception, or in some cases, as you move the taps, could you go and favor one station versus another? Over to you, Mel.
Well, if you remember, the big advance came in another issue. See, you didn't keep up with the issue. If I tested you, I have to give you a failing mark, Vic. I'm just kidding with you. If you remember a further issue, that what they said, to make this arm up out of a piece of metal, like a sort of a springy piece of metal, you could use like a hacksaw blade and all, or whatever, something that's had a little springiness to it, and you now slided it across the coil. In other words, now you could have, you didn't have to make the tap, you slid this across the coil, Vic, over.
Piece of brass.
So that sliding piece of metal was now touching the bare portions of each one of those turns of the coil wound on either the toilet paper roll or the oatmeal box roll, and therefore you could continuously almost change those number of turns and find the spot that gave you the strongest reception of a particular station. When you had that sliding metal object, Mel, did you tune that for strongest signal, or did you sometimes have the ability to select one station over another? Back to you, Mel.
Diddled. Got to maybe tune in a little stronger station. WOR was the strong one, I remember. That I remember. 770, 710, I don't remember, or whatever it was. WOR, AM. And what you got was, you heard something in those little pair of phones that were bought surplus on Portland Street for 75 cents. The World War II phones. If you bought a pair of those phones with a leather headband and you heard something, Dick, your mouth fell open. I mean, this is 65 years ago, so I will say things have changed just a mite. The kids today don't appreciate what we went through, Dick, if you remember correctly. Over.
Good question.
Yeah, I think those headphones had something like a 2,000 ohm impedance. The person with the question, give us your call letters and name, and go ahead with the question.
KC2YDT. Nick, if you could add me to the list with questions as well, that would be great.
Okay, we got you on the list. So, Alan, as you can tell, you may have been born a little bit too late to really appreciate those early days of Crystal Radio. There was a guy down the street where I lived on Yoakum Avenue in Farmingdale, and I had a 40, I eventually added audio to my 20 meter, or was it a 40 meter transmitter, I'm not sure which, and he was using a Crystal radio, and when I had my audio output AM modulated, the 807 rig, he came running into my property one day saying, I could hear what you were saying. How was that happening? I recognized your voice. KC2RFN, K2RIW, you got it, Alan.
KC2RFN. Yeah, the magic of radio is being lost on the current generation. Unfortunately, it was not lost on me. I was always fascinated on it. Even in the early 70s when I was getting into it, it was still magical to me. And Mike Mell, a variable capacitor, that I didn't know what in the world that would have been. I was able to make sort of a tuner by using a mixture of aluminum foil and I think cardboard, and I was able to separate the stations a little bit, but I can never remember how I did it. But it did work somewhat. And it was WBLI was the big station I was separating from some other big station. It may have been WOR. But anyway, can I get on to my real question?
Go for it.
Okay, when I was working with Andy, WA2CDL, with the ATV transmitter we have, or repeater, we were talking about the amplifier, and I was, for the first time, really talking about amplifiers. And I learned that you need to drive amplifiers with a certain amount of power. And I just accepted that at first, and so I started thinking about it, and I said, wait a second. Why do I need to drive, let's say, a 1,000-watt amplifier with 100 watts of power? But why can't I just put in, you know, say, you know, 10 watts? Let's say the signal could be represented peak to peak by 10 watts. Why do I need to pump 100 in there? And the reason I say this is if you look at operational amplifiers we use in our circuits, you know, all you're really doing is biasing the output with your signal, and you know, you can put in millivolts and you can pull out volts. It's not as if the amplifier section is going to build its power off of the power that it was given to it by the initiating signal. So why does it matter that your rig can put out 100 watts to drive this next stage of the amplifier when it's going to start from 0 volts or zero power anyway? It has to go from the ground up. It's not going to build off of the signal that's being injected into it. So I don't understand why you need to drive it with such high power. Do you follow my question, Dick?
Grounded grid?
I sure do. And you've fallen into a little bit of a trap, Alan, with reference to a operational amplifier comparison. Whenever you take an amplifier and take some of the output signal and feed it back to the input, some or significant amount of any non-linearity that exists in the amplifier becomes negated. A good percentage of the non-linearity becomes negated. In other words, if your amplifier was producing quite a bit of second harmonic distortion, you took some of the signal and you fed it back and did everything just right, the gain will decrease a little bit, but the linearity of the amplifier will increase. The people who designed operational amplifiers way back in the dark ages of around 1920, some of the very first analog computing devices really were operational amplifiers. And they discovered that, yes, you lose some gain when you use feedback, but you gain linearity, and now how can you optimize that? Okay, make the operational amplifier have a tremendous amount of gain. Make it act like it's got a gain of infinity. And as such, you now can feed back 99.9% of the signal and still have a reasonable amount of forward gain, and now essentially all of the nonlinearity of the system disappears. A modern-day good operational amplifier has between 90 and 110 decibels of gain. They might average around 100. What does that mean? 100 decibels of gain. There's a whole lot of individual stages. Let me drop. If you took a look, if you really used your microscope or you go to the right article and you find out the complete schematic diagram of what's inside that operational amplifier, you'll see a significant number of cascaded gain stages that are all essentially DC coupled. That takes a lot of smarts to do that just right. And they typically have 100 decibels of gain. 100 decibels of gain is a 10 billion to 1 power ratio. You've got so many stages of gain that what comes out is 10 billion times stronger than went in it. Okay? At the milliwatt level of an operational amplifier all inside that integrated circuit chip, relatively easy to do with modern circuits. Now you take your 807 tube, your 813 tube, your 4CX250B, or any of these more modern tubes, where the total amount of gain inside the tube is somewhere between 10 and 18 decibels. Not 100 decibels, 10 or 18 dB of decibels. That amplifier, that high power tube, is made to produce watts, but there's only one single stage there. If you drive the grid and ground the cathode of that tube, you will get, in the case of a 4CX250B external anode tube used on the final stage of many of the Collins transmitters, you will get 17 dB of gain, but you get not perfect linearity. Your third order intermodulation distortion might not quite meet the FCC specs. Let me drop. So you could, in theory, take some of the output and feed it back, but there's a much easier way of doing it. Someone discovered that if instead of grounding the cathode and feeding the control grid, you ground the control grid and feed the cathode. A little bit of difference in impedance matching. You get a little bit less gain, but now you're using a kind of automatic feedback within the tube when you do that. Your 17 dB of gain goes down to more like 10 or 12 dB of gain when you do that with a 4CX250B. The drive power you put on the cathode, some of it gets coupled straight through, but now you need to get the 200 watts of output, you're going to need 20 watts of drive because it's only got 10 dB of gain. So the high power tubes with only one stage that we've got, and because we usually want the linearity and we drive the cathode, you need some real power in order to turn that tube on. You haven't got the zillion dB of gain you've got inside of that operational amplifier. Now, you could, in theory, add some more tubes and other transistors to that 4CX250B circuit such that now only a milliwatt of drive is required instead of 10 watts of drive or 20 watts of drive. You could do that, and for reasons of, history and tradition, that hasn't become a popular technique. When a guy wants an afterburner, he usually already has a 50 or 100 watts of transmitter power, and he wants to bring it up to a kilowatt. He only needs 10 or 12 dB of gain, so to speak. So the amplifiers you and I can now easily buy are popular. It could have been done with higher gain inside the box, and it wouldn't have cost a whole lot of money if that had become a popular technique. KC2RFN, good question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I got it. Now I see the difference. So I was looking at this just because an amplifier, like an operational amplifier, that can work one way, and these amplifiers for radio work a different way. So now, just one last question. If I were to put 1 volt in instead, a one watt signal in to this 10 to 18 dB amplifier, can I expect anything out, or is there a critical level I have to reach before it'll start to perform?
Another darn good question, and there's a yes and a no to that. 90% of the time the answer is yes. If your amplifier is truly linear, and if it had, just to round off the numbers, 10 decibels of gain, 10 decibels of gain happens to be a 10 to 1 power ratio, happens to be a 3.3 voltage ratio. But let's talk about power ratio. If I put in 20 watts to a particular amplifier that's got 10 dB of gain, in theory, 200 watts comes out. If I put in 2 watts, 20 watts comes out. If I put in 2/10 of a watt, 2 watts come out. In other words, whatever power I put in, multiply it by 10, that's what comes out. If it's a truly linear amplifier, which has no crossover distortion, and a well-tuned one with good Class A bias does do that. Everything is linear. In theory, you can put in a microwatt of power, and you'll get out 10 microwatts of power. And with the right kind of instrumentation, you can confirm it. It's linear all the way down to the noise of the tube, where the signal you put in is still being multiplied by 10 coming out, but if the noise of the tube overcomes your instrumentation, you may not see the signal, but it's really there. Believe it or not, you can put in a signal to any kind of an amplifier which is 20 decibels weaker than the noise. Will the amplifier still amplify the signal? Absolutely. The amplifier doesn't have the intelligence to know the difference between signal and noise. It just takes that whole conglomerate and gains it up. And so if you have the right kind of instrumentation, even if the signal is 20 dB below the noise, it's still getting 10 dB of gain. Your global positioning satellite receiver starts off with a signal that is 25 dB below the noise of the first few stages of your receiver. And with all the back-end processing, it manages to suck that signal out of the noise. So complete linearity, you've got it all the way down to minus infinity in
repeater, timeout, repeater.
All the way down to minus infinity of decibels of power. That's for a truly linear Class A amplifier. For a Class C amplifier, the good news about Class C, we use them on FM circuits. They got higher efficiency. Good Class C amplifier can run 70% efficiency, sometimes beyond. A truly linear Class A amplifier rarely gets up to 50% efficiency. So Class C amplifiers, yes, a lot more efficiency, but you go below a certain power level. The Class C amplifier, by definition, the control grid bias is twice beyond cutoff. In other words, beyond a certain weakness of signal, you don't get a chance to bias the tube into the conduction region and nothing comes out. So with a Class C amplifier, you can decide to lower the input power by 20 dB, but still the input power is there, and essentially nothing comes out of the amplifier. I used to use that technique on one of my high power transmitters one day. Back to you, Alan, if you need any clarification on that. KC2 RFN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, thank you, Dick. That definitely answers the question. I appreciate it. KC2 RFN.
Hey, Mel, sounds like we've almost got a satisfied customer there. Mel, I hear tell that you've got a question. And I wonder if it's going to be science, wireless engineering, antennas. K2KEY, one of our rare questioners of the TechNet, K2RAW. You got it, Mel.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, due to the situation, I guess that I more or less spoke to you about, and I don't know how much longer I'll be. I have to take some medication pretty soon, and I don't know. I'll try. I'll most likely wind up listening. I doubt if you can hear me with my handy talkie from here, if I can reach the repeater with the handy talkie in the bedroom, but I'll listen anyhow. But question today, let me let it drop and I'll maybe you can help me. This is KEY. Just hold on one second. Okay. Well, today I had some, this afternoon I had a gentleman come with his son, with a van, and they dismantled my electronics laboratory. I got rid of all the test equipment. And a lot of stuff. In fact, wound up loading that van up. There was stuff I didn't even remember hardly anymore. And all those different pieces of equipment wound up in the van, and then in fact it was so loaded that his son had to sit with a couple of pieces in the front seat. Anyhow, he said to me one of the pieces of equipment was a Hewlett Packard 8640B signal generator. This was the last of them. I had told him I think that was the latest of this 8640 series was the /004. But he asked me, he says, I'm surprised that, you know, you didn't have a 005 or a 6. I said, you know, I can't recall if they ever had one. And he says he thought he saw one. And so I said, you know, listen to our text desk and I'll ask the Maven. So, Maven, was this to your knowledge? I can't find any reference to it. Was there such a thing as an 8640B/005 or something, 6, Hewlett Packard generator, over.
Yeah, this is one of the best pieces of equipment that Hewlett Packard ever built, that 8640 signal generator. I think it runs from roughly 10 megacycles to something like 512, and if you use the doubler, I think it goes to something like 2,000 megs. And the magic of that particular signal generator is that it is not frequency synthesized. It's got an extremely well-built variable frequency oscillator, piston-controlled variable frequency oscillator. It's the main heart of the thing. It gets mixed together with another frequency, goes through a bunch of amplifier stages, a bunch of filtering stages, and out comes the signal that you care about. And the signal it produces is extremely quiet and very well frequency controlled. And you can, because it's got a built-in frequency counter, you can turn the dial until you get the frequency you really care about. It's got a very accurate frequency counter. Then you go to the lock mode, and the machine does an analog feedback, which means that as everything is heating up and the oscillator wants to drift, the machine will correct its main variable frequency oscillator such that the counter continues to read the same frequency. So it is a freak lock loop system. And that, believe it or not, there's some real magic in how quiet and how clean that particular signal generator is. Very well designed piece of equipment. I own one. It's one of the best things I think I've ever acquired. However, the 004, 005, 006 dash numbers, I don't know, Mel. Sorry to say, I don't know. So anybody within the sound of my voice that knows anything about the 8640, a Bernie K2YO, or no, Hal, K6DPZ, he's tuned an awful lot of those things over his lifetime. If he happens to be around, he could tell us. He's the first person we should go to. He probably is the expert on the East Coast for 80...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
He's probably the expert on the East Coast for Hewlett-Packard 8640 signal generator. So I hope Hal is on frequency. If not, we're going to have to seek him out to get the answer to your question, ML. K6 Delta Papa Zulu, if you're there, Hal. We need you. K2RAW in the TechNet. Anybody else know the answer to that? The higher dash numbers for the accessories you can add to a 8640 signal generator beyond the frequency doubler. Give me your call letters if you happen to know. Now, it looks like we don't have anybody on frequency tonight, but you got to get a hold of Hal. I think there's a 90% chance he's got the answer to that one. And Mel, let's go right now to your mailbag if you feel up to it. It's up to you. Let's go right now to, in fact, of the people who originally signed in, we got a late check-in after that, but let's go to the mailbag now if you would like to. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, all right, I haven't got much. I haven't been really keeping up with it, but I could say more or less got the full gist of the situation here in the last month, so my mind has not been really much on anything at all. I'm just looking back here and see if I can filter out something. It's not that important. The 004 that I had was I thought was the last of them because this thing was also had what they call VOR localizer on it and also glide scope coverage, which was the 329 to 335 megahertz system that was for adjusting glide scope or the VOR system. So that was when I was involved for a period of time. I bought that with that, bought a new version, new generator, which was a piece of but was fancier looking than the Hewlett Packard. I'm looking for something, Dick. Hold on a minute. Okay, here's one. This has been around for a while. I don't know. I have an underground conduit pipe, aluminum pipe. If I just ran enough one wire through it, can I use that like a coaxial cable? In other words, the conduit to be used as the shield and a single wire through it. Will it be a type of coaxial cable? That's a new one. Make your own coax stick over.
That's a darn good question. And depending on the conditions, with some reservations, the answer is yes. All the coax cable we all build happens to have an outer spherical, outer cylindrical conductor, sometimes braid, sometimes hardline as a real piece of aluminum tubing or copper tubing. In the case of Andrew Heliax, it's a copper tubing with ridges in it. And there's some kind of a support structure to hold the wire in the center, down the center. That could be solid polyethylene. It could be foamed polyethylene. It could be little bitty discs or bamboo line. So the center conductor being directly in the center of the outer cylindrical conductor is the conventional way coax is made. Believe it or not, there's nothing magic about the center conductor being in the center. You could, if you want to, design coaxial cable where the center conductor is way off to one side, coming fairly close to touching the outer conductor. That would be very lopsided center conductor, very lopsided coaxial cable, and in theory, it would work like